What do you think international institutions should be looking at in terms of helping countries respond to this? I don't know if you might call it an energy crisis, but it's certainly
a... I think so. I think we're in a global energy crisis. I just met with people from, you know, a series of emerging market countries in Southeast Asia, deeply concerned about what high prices are doing. And my concern is that looking at the elements, it looks to me like it's going to get worse over the next few months. And an organization like the IMF and other World Bank have to look pretty carefully at what's going to happen over the next 3, 4, 5 months, what it will do to countries' balance of payments, economic and even political stability, because really things are not going to stand still.
Disruption in the energy markets is not new. The energy crises in the early 70s, the 80s, and the early 2000s were all challenging in their own ways, but none were so intertwined with other emergencies like climate change and a global pandemic. Today's guest has won the Pulitzer Prize and many other accolades for his writings about the global energy markets. His latest book is The New Map.
I'm Daniel Yergin, and I'm vice chairman of S&P Global, but I also write books, and I've done books on political economy and economic history and geopolitics. Maybe the best known one is called The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power, and that was a book that I was fortunate enough to receive the Pulitzer Prize for. But my new book is called The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations. And if you think about it, that's what we're all living through right now.
Great. Thank you so much for that. And welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So with all the advancements in renewable energy, we've been hearing about, in the past decade and more recently, one would assume, or at least hope, that our dependence on oil and gas would be waning. Is it?
No, it's not. Renewables are growing, but oil and gas consumption are growing as well. And the world still uses about 80% hydrocarbons.
Wow.
Wind and solar costs have come down a lot. You know, both of those are 50-year-old technologies, but it's only in the last 10 years that they've become competitive, and they've become very competitive. Costs come way down, and they're growing, and there's a lot of government support for them. There's a lot of investor support for them. Their costs are going up somewhat right now, but the world is still primarily runs on hydrocarbons.
Hmm. And so in your latest book, The New Map, you lay out essentially the supply lines for energy, past and future, and how the power of nations is founded on their ability to either extract fossil fuels or secure what they need in some way. Where do the major powers stand today in terms of energy security, as you describe it?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because energy security actually over the last 10 years has more or less fallen off the table as a consideration for many parts of the world. And I think part of it was because of the growth of the shale in the United States, which took the U.S. from importing 60% of its oil to being self-sufficient and being the world's largest producer of oil and gas. And the consequence of that is that there was a kind of sense of everything's fine. And didn't have to really worry about it. That, of course, has changed in the last year, because really this energy crisis, this global energy crisis that we're on now, did not start on February 24th when Russia invaded Ukraine. It started in the second half of last year when the global economy came so strongly out of COVID, and suddenly energy markets that had been very slack became very tight, and prices were already going up before those Russian troops crossed the border into Ukraine.
And so you mentioned how shale gave a boost to the U.S. in terms of their energy supply. What about, other powers in the world like Russia and like China, perhaps?
Well, let's focus on Russia. Mm-hmm. Russia has been, for a number of years now, an energy superpower. I quote Putin in the New Map, where he was asked, is Russia an energy superpower? He said, I don't like that term. It sounds too Cold War-ish. Well, it is kind of Cold War-ish right now. but he sure liked the money and he sure liked the political clout that came with it. But I think because of the decisions he's made and Europe's response to them, which is to say, we really don't want to depend on Russian energy anymore. I think right now, Putin has some real high cards and is very intent on disrupting the European economy. But I think a couple of years from now, Russia will continue to be a major producer, but it's not going to be, I think, anymore a energy superpower. It's going to be much more tied into China and, in a sense, dependent on China as its growing market. China's position is they're well endowed with coal, and they're one of the world's major oil producers, but not enough. They import 75% of their oil. They've been building up their natural gas consumption, which means imports. And they're going gung-ho all out for renewables, for wind and solar. So they're moving on all those fronts. But I think China has a sense of vulnerability and insecurity because it's so dependent on global markets for its oil, and it regards that as a security problem.
Okay, so the war in Ukraine is obviously very much about Russia wanting to firm up its own energy security. And in your book, you place the war at the very center of this geopolitical shift, as you describe it, in energy trade that's essentially dividing East and West. If Ukraine is so important to Russia's energy security in terms of Ukraine's resources, how did Ukraine's independence come about in 1991? I mean, how did that happen?
Well, there are two parts to that, which is actually Ukraine, from an energy point of view, was important to Russia mainly as a transit. Most of Russian gas to Europe used to go through Ukraine, and they've been working assiduously to build these other pipelines like Nord Stream to get around Ukraine. I think that Putin's obsession. He can, as you said, 1991, Ukraine became an independent country. It had only fleetingly been an independent country at the end of the First World War. And particularly since, the last 10 or 12 years, it's developed a real sense of national identity. Putin refused to recognize that. He repeatedly said Ukraine is not a country, that two-thirds of it used to be Russian and one-third was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And I think he saw Ukraine, first an independent Ukraine that was integrated into the global economy, would be a threat to Russia because of the message it would send and because of the kind of close affinity. And then I think it's become clearer in recent years, and maybe it was his 2 years of isolation during COVID, his extraordinary isolation during COVID, he started to dream of recreating not the Soviet Union, but the Russian Empire. So I think this became very much tied into energy because the gas, the big fights between Ukraine, independent Ukraine, and Russia were over natural gas and the price of gas and cutting off gas to Ukraine and cutting off gas to Europe. But I think now, as Putin expresses himself, we see more and more that he had this messianic dream about a Russian empire that he wanted to recreate, and he never accepted the outcome of the Cold War, the way the Cold War ended and the way the Soviet Union ended. And so great deep sense of grievance that he's been expressing for decades. And I think he had a series of calculations about how this would all go, and all of them turned out to be wrong so far.
And so he did manage to build Russia as a great supplier of energy, especially to Europe. And
absolutely.
Yeah. And you speak in your book of Europe's dependence on Russian oil and how Vladimir Putin thought he could survive the sanctions because of it. But you also point out that public opinion is now putting pressure on companies to step back from Russian oil because of the war. How much influence does public opinion have in energy trade generally, and how might it play into geopolitics of energy in the coming years, do you think?
That's a very good point, because I remember before the war, just when it started, talking to people in the U.S. government here, and they, you know, had this, they saw the buildup, and they had this very large panoply of sanctions. The one thing they weren't going to sanction was Russian energy because of Europe's dependence. And they thought that you couldn't do that, that it would fracture the coalition. But I think you point to something that was really new, which was public opinion saying, we don't want Russian energy. We don't want to send money to Russia that they're going to use to further their war in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And you had dock workers who wouldn't handle Russian energy products. You had investors putting pressure on companies about importing. And so you had, even before the sanctions were there, you had the major Western companies, which had been very important in the development of Russian energy since the end of the Soviet Union. And by the way, with the strong encouragement of Western governments, including the United States, because it was seen, you know, it's Russia, post-communist, has to be integrated into the world economy. So the governments, you know, I remember going to several conferences sponsored by the U.S. government about U.S.-Russian energy dialogue. Mm. But these companies now were getting this pressure. And before sanctions were there, you just saw them saying, we're leaving, we're getting out of here. Now, it's not easy to get out of there because you may have several thousand employees and you don't just pick up everything and leave in the middle of the night. It's complicated, but Western companies are leaving, and Russia is going to not have the access to Western technology, and that's one of the things that's going to cause its former position as energy superpower to deteriorate, because it just won't have the capabilities that it's had up till now, because it's been integrated into a global economy.
Mm. So sticking with this public opinion thing for a minute, as you explain in your book, shale gas extraction was instrumental in putting the U.S. back on the map in terms of energy security. But the public are not happy about that. You know, fracking is still a bad word around here.
Well, and, I think let me disagree with you.
Okay.
It's not popular with some people. You know, there was a lot of emotion around it and not really very well understood. Mm-hmm. It's now been, you know, practiced for going on to a decade and a half.
Yeah.
And it's part of the system. And all of the sort of many of the environmental problems that people said that were there are not there. I know one of the biggest opponents to shale on environmental grounds was this fellow named Vladimir Putin.
Hmm.
And I had personal experience of that. And I tell the story in the new map that I was at the St. Petersburg International Economic Conference, and he was up there on the platform with Chancellor Merkel. But they said, okay, you can ask the first question. So I started to ask him the question that I'm sure the IMF and many other people have been asking for years and years and years. What are you going to do to reduce your overdependence on revenues from oil and gas? And by accident, I mentioned the word shale, mm-hmm. and he erupted. He started shouting at me in front of 3,000 people, saying it's barbaric, it's terrible, it's an environmental disaster. And as I reflected on it, I became clear why he didn't like shale, mm-hmm. because he saw the day would come when U.S. shale gas would compete in Europe with Russian gas, which is exactly what's happening. And he saw that it would enhance the strategic position of the United States and its influence in the world, and that happened. But I think, you know, but you could see the change.
Yeah.
Europe turned aside a shipment of LNG last year from the United States because it was shale gas. This year, there are delegations of Europeans who are coming to the United States trying to sign up LNG made from shale gas as alternative supplies to make up for Russian gas. So I would say that there's some people who don't like it, others do. Mm. And it's been economically very beneficial to the United States. And I'll tell you, the world would be in a lot worse position today if it wasn't for shale development in the United States.
And we should just explain here for the listening audience, if they're not familiar with LNG, what LNG is.
So LNG, otherwise known as liquefied natural gas, is where you take a stream of natural gas, which is a gas, and at very low temperatures, in effect, you compress it into a liquid. And you can take that liquid, put it into a ship, and ship it anywhere in the world. So that was a business that really, I mean, it actually developed in the United States. The first shipment of LNG went to England in 1959 in response to the killer fogs that came from coal. Mm. But it really took off in Asia, where Japan and then South Korea turned to like Indonesia and Brunei and Malaysia and had these long-term contracts. But now LNG is being produced around the world. But it turns out that the United States has really become a very big producer. And Europe today sees it as a strategic asset that Europe depends on. Hmm. So things change. They don't stay the same.
Absolutely, and very quickly. So I'm just going to remind our listeners that our guest today is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Daniel Yergin. So back to Ukraine just for a minute, and you know the geopolitics at play based on what's going on in Ukraine and Russian energy with regards to China in particular. Like, how important is China in terms of energy supply, and how could that dynamic further fragment the global trade of energy?
Well, China's big importance is as a consumer on overall energy. It is the largest consumer of energy in the world. The U.S. still uses more oil, but China is moving up. But that's one reason that China is promoting electric cars, electric vehicles. It has half the electric cars in the world are in China to reduce its dependence on oil for climate. And also, I think China sees it as a competitive strength that it could never catch up with the European, US, Japanese, Korean car makers with conventional cars with internal combustion engines. It's trying to leapfrog to electric cars. It's already exporting electric cars to Europe, and it sees electric cars as an important export market for it. So EVs, electric cars, is one of China's responses to the current situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got to say, I traveled to Cairo recently within the past couple of months. And, you know, just stepping out onto the streets of Cairo is a pretty sobering experience in terms of imagining a world where everyone is driving clean electric vehicles. I mean, it's just not happening there. And it's not happening in a lot of the most populous countries in the world. And you speak of cars, you know, in your book. How important are cars when it comes to the growing global demand for oil and gas?
Well, I think transportation is the number one consumer of oil. Insofar as gas is used to generate electricity, it would play an important role in fueling electric cars. Hmm. And electric car sales are certainly, you know, increasing significantly, not only in China, but in Europe. And they're starting to in the United States, too. And of course, there are a lot of incentives and a lot of regulations that are encouraging it. But probably what encourages more than anything else are high gasoline prices.
Right.
Around the world, governments, you know, and countries are really being hit by high prices right now. And where they can, people will buy an electric car. We looked at it. Governments around the world are cutting taxation on gasoline, call it petrol, whatever you want to call it, because it's such a problem for average people, for consumers. These high energy prices are obviously not only an engine of inflation, but they inflict pain on people around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things to be concerned about is that, you know, for 50 years, Russia and the Soviet Union before that said, we're a reliable supplier. Whatever happens to politics, we're going to just continue to honor our contracts. Mm-hmm. Right now, there's a second battlefield in this war. There's a battlefield in Ukraine, but the second front is in Europe, where Russia is reducing natural gas supplies and driving up prices. And Putin laid it out at his recent St. Petersburg conference, where he said the result will be social instability, populist governments coming to power in Europe, and a very strange phrase he used, and a change in the current elites in Europe. Hmm. And so, I mean, he's basically trying to create as much economic hardship in Europe as possible, and the German economics minister, Robert Habeck, has pointed that out, in order to kind of crack this coalition that's supporting Ukraine in its battle with Russia.
Mm-hmm. So the pandemic has thrown another variable into this complicated mix. you know, dramatically changing the way people work and do business. And I love how in your book, how you frame it in the new map as shifting from molecules or gas to electrons, and how digitalization is competing now with transportation, using electrons to connect people rather than molecules to move them. To what extent does this characterize, do you think, the new energy transition?
Well, I think it's in a very important part of it. You know, you sort of think about counterfactual history. If this terrible pandemic had happened 20 years ago, we wouldn't have been able to function in the way we did by, you know, people pivoting to Zoom or Teams or other electronic channels. It just couldn't have been done. Mm-hmm. And once it got going, you know, so much businesses. I was talking to the CEO of a major mining company, and he said he hasn't been in his office for 2 years.
Wow.
You know, so people are just managing things differently. And so the nature of work changes, is a, you know, at least in many parts of the world. I mean, in some parts of the world, it's like 2 or 3 days a week that they're back in their office. It changes travel. So instead of using molecules, you'll use electrons. So it's kind of refashioning the way economies work. So that's, you know, one of the, shall we say, unanticipated consequences of the pandemic. I mean, there's so many people I know who said when they left their offices in March, they thought they'd be back in a week or two, not, you know, come back 2 years later like an archaeologist looking at an old civilization.
That's right. And so this transition, you know, there's obviously still a growing demand for oil and gas, but renewables are also, you know, very, I mean, a lot of companies are investing a lot of money into renewables that brings minerals into the mix that could potentially benefit some of, you know, the global south, essentially. And you speak of that in your book. How does this demand for minerals fit into all this?
Well, I think it's going to be much bigger than people realize. You know, we tend to think of wind and solar and say, well, the wind is free and the sun is free, but they require enormous amount of materials to make them. And electric cars require 2.5-3 times as much copper, for instance, as a conventional car. And you start adding it up, and we've been doing it, I have this new study that's coming out on copper. And you see, you know, you start just doing the numbers, the arithmetic, the demand for minerals is going to be much greater than people think. And, you know, to open a new mine, the International Energy Agency says it takes 16 years.
Wow.
Well, 16 years takes us to 2038, and you have these 2050 goals. So where are you going to get the supplies? And I think there's a new geopolitics that will emerge around minerals too, is where they are, what countries they are. I mean, they can be very beneficial, as you say, for emerging markets, developing world. But, you know, the governments also have to decide what they do with the money and avoid that perennial resource curse and, you know, diversify their economies. But mining will loom very large. And mining is also an energy-intensive activity. And the way I describe in the new map, we'll move from a world of what's called big oil to a world of big shovels, a lot of mining. And I think have to look very closely at what the requirements are, the physical requirements to achieve that, where they are and where the materials are processed. And, you know, it gets complicated and it gets kind of caught up in the new geopolitics of what people are calling great power competition.
And so lastly, the way things are going with demand for oil and gas just increasing and supplies and production sliding, we're going to need so much more gas and oil. And investors are moving now more toward cleaner energy. And there's a stigma attached to oil and gas, at least to a certain degree these days. So where do you think the money is going to come from for the investment that is needed to access more oil and gas?
I think that's I'm not sure if it's a problem or a challenge, but it's out there, absolutely, there's been what we might call preemptive underinvestment on the assumption that we were going to get very quickly to that different energy economy. It's going to happen. But, you know, we just had our big conference that we do every year in Houston. And one of the senior people from one of the three big wind turbine manufacturing companies said, you want to put a new wind turbine on land in Europe, the permitting process takes 7 years. So these things don't happen quickly. So I think we see some sign now. The G7 is starting to say, well, maybe it is okay to finance energy development in Senegal or Uganda and some of these other countries for diversity, for security, and because they need the revenues. So I think we need a kind of rebalancing. I think it's great to see the growth of wind and solar, but they're not going to be the whole answer. And I think oil and gas with carbon abatement will be a very important part of the mix. So I think people have to rethink kind of the time, have a more realistic attitude towards time, and then to be balanced and keep your eye on the development, the economic development needs of the 80% of the people who live in the developed world.
Well, Daniel Yergin is the author of several books on the geopolitics of energy supply, his latest being The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations. Daniel Yergin, thanks so much.
Thank you. Great to join you.
Daniel Yergin is vice chairman of S&P Global. He's also won a Pulitzer for his book, The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. Look for other IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Subscribe and leave us a review if you feel so inclined. It'll help others discover IMF podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.